Let's talk about the future of news.
I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
The state of journalism today.
Telling both sides of a controversial story.
I think you must be unbiased.
It's honesty, fairness, truth.
That is our job. That is our job. That is our job. That is our job.
Welcome once again to the Our Man in Stockholm podcast. My name is Philip O'Connor, but if you've found it your way this far, you probably kind of knew that already. It's a Friday afternoon as I record, and this is not like me. Usually you would have got your podcast on Monday, latest Tuesday, but it's been that kind of week. So there's a couple of podcasts in the pipeline, and sometimes these things happen and sometimes these things don't. So the original podcast that I was supposed to do has been put off, not for the foreseeable future, but a couple of days in the future at least. And then the second podcast that I was going to bring you, I haven't actually been able to get hold of the person I wanted to interview. The third podcast, the interview for which I did this morning, turned out to be so newsworthy that I can't actually put it out as a podcast. I have to put it through a process of journalism and then it will be published somewhere else. Things turned up in a conversation with the person that I had that you just... It's not that I wouldn't like to give it to you guys, but I just figure that, you know, it's going to reach a much bigger audience if it goes out through one of the big news agencies that I work for. So that is why I'm sitting here at just about 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon and talking to you. But it's not like that there aren't things to talk about. One of the things that I did want to talk to you about this week is to do with a radio documentary that I listened to yesterday. But since I listened to that, there's been some breaking news out of Ireland, and it's almost a global type of story. Not that anybody around the world is going to be interested in this, but it's the kind of thing that's happening more and more, and it has a lot to do with social media and with media in general. And it's just one of those things that, you know, we need to grab it by the horns now and sort out what's what before people start to make their excuses for what is essentially very bad behaviour. So what's after happening is a columnist called Owen Harris, who wrote for the Sunday Independent, was found to be one of the people behind a sort of a sock puppet account, right? Now, it was described initially in news reports as a fake Twitter account. It wasn't a fake Twitter account. It was very much a real Twitter account. The fake, in inverted commas, I think that quote sort of came from the Sunday Independent where he worked when they announced that they were letting him go, right? Now, that in itself was one thing. And I said, oh, you know, the things that were said, et cetera, they weren't, we're not behind them, but, you know, he's a great guy or a great columnist or whatever. Nah, you know, he said things and he had to go. So then overnight, what happened was that it revealed that this account had been harassing certain people, virtually all of them left-wing, many of them from Northern Ireland. Harris would have been known. Now, I wouldn't be all that familiar with his work. I seem to remember reading one column, and occasionally I would read like the lead of his column, the first paragraph, and he's just been writing the same anti-Sinn Féin, anti-IRA shit for the last 20 years. There's nothing creative in it. It was just bile. And it's, you know, it was, even before the internet existed, it was clickbait. It was like, okay, let's see what this frothing madman has written again this week. You know, what sort of, you know, historical misinterpretation has he gone for? Who is he going to sort of, you know, sail very close to the libel winds on? And that was basically his USP, and he did his thing, and somebody was dumb enough to pay him for it. And that somebody just happened to be the Sunday Independent. So then it came out overnight that a journalist of the Irish Examiner newspaper, that this account had been sending her messages and comments to do with her appearance, some of which were of a sexual nature. Yeah, just basically, you know, stuff that you shouldn't be doing. And this is why this is so important, because it has so much to do with the dynamics of power in media. And media is one of those places where power and the exertion of it is such a huge part of journalism and of media, and the power that one exerts in that situation, the power that one can exert in that situation. If you're the top dog with a, like, you know, a late night talk show or a talk show that has millions of viewers, you wield immense power. And we've seen that in American TV, where very, very powerful people have been able to do things and get away with them solely because people have reputations. So the dynamic of that really is what I wanted to examine today, what I wanted to look at a little bit closer. Because here you have, in the Irish Examiner, this was a young journalist who was, you know, at the start of her career. She's from Derry in Northern Ireland. And, you know, immediately these accusations come out that, you know, of her sympathies for Sinn Féin and this guy. You know, when you're attacking another journalist's credibility, you know, and for me, go ahead, attack me all you want, right? I'm a big boy, I can do this, I've been doing it for years, and I don't mind. You know, that's what I'm here for, is to meet some of these things. There are no, I don't have any secrets. I don't have any secret accounts. You know, I, to my detriment, or, you know, it actually cost me money, I'd say that I am open and honest about what I do. So there's, you know, this idea of in journalism that everybody's supposed to be neutral. You're not. You're supposed to be objective. And indeed, if you listen back to the podcast over the last few months, it's probably about six or eight months ago, Sean Murray, who made the film Unquiet Graves about the Glenan gang and what they did in Northern Ireland and the collusion with Northern Irish security forces, he was one of the targets of Owen Harris. And he was one of the targets of this account, this sock puppet account that was set up. And if you, I specifically asked him that question because it's one of those questions that I know kind of where he stands on it about neutrality and objectivity. And he's basically saying that you have to do your best to be objective, but you know, you don't have to be neutral. You never have to be neutral about a story because, you know, in even claiming to be neutral, and I think the great Irish journalist Vincent Brown, who ran newspapers, I mean, the fact that he's not in public life anymore is a bit of a disaster for Irish media. But he would have said very much the same thing. It's like, you're messing around. You know, if you think that you're not bringing your own baggage to the table, that you can make some sort of conscious decision to remove everything that you know and that you've learned and that you are from a story, you are fooling yourself and you're trying to fool your readers. But that said, you can try to be objective. You can try to put stuff through the process of verification, which is journalism, and come up with something which tells both sides of the story or which gives a balanced and accurate view of it. But this idea that you can be neutral is an absolute nonsense. But when you attack, as I say, especially a young journalist, especially a young female journalist, because again, if you look at the Committee to Protect Journalists, you know, there's constant campaigns talking about what happens to young female journalists. There was one here in Sweden recently. I think it was actually National Press Freedom Day at the start of this week, if I'm not mistaken. And I saw from some Swedish colleagues the kind of things that they had to put up with. And the things that women get sent are so much worse. Like, I had some guy during the week sending me DMs, you know, because I was talking about a particular case in Ireland where somebody from the National Party, or essentially a Nazi party, was involved. And I was going to look at, no Nazis, I don't want to hear from them, you know. And this guy's gone in my DMs going, there's no such thing as Nazis in Ireland. It's like, yeah, and you're probably one of them, right? But a female reporter, a female journalist doing the same thing, the things they get are so much worse. The violence in them, the threats of violence, the sexual violence, the misogyny in these things. And people send these messages because they think they can get away with it, right? And that also applies to Owen Harris and to whoever else was with him, was on that account, because they said that there was a number of people behind the account, Barbara something, right? So they all thought that they could get away with it. And this is a common thing, especially in criminality, it's a common thing where, you know, you don't do things. Nobody's ever worried about the sentence, right? The sentence doesn't put anybody off committing any crime. Never does, never did, never will, right? The only thing that will stop most people committing a crime is the fear of getting caught. And the only thing that will stop most people from doing things and from sending threats on social media is the fear of getting caught and the fear of getting outed and the fear that Owen Harris is now living through, that he may never work in mainstream Irish journalism again, right? But in the beginning, when they set these things up a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years ago, they do it because they think they can get away with it, right? So from this pseudo-anonymity, they sit there and they make these comments to women, to female reporters, to reporters like me, to news reporters, to weather people, to sports commentators. And they say these things and they think, OK, well, I'm hiding behind this this anonymity. Now, as the great Irish producer and broadcaster Pat O'Mahony used to tell me, never do anything on the internet that you wouldn't like to see printed out and put on a billboard outside your mother's house. And that's essentially what's after happening to Harris and Co. now. Now, the rest of the people, as I say, behind it haven't been revealed just yet. But with any luck, they will be revealed, because this is an attack on the media, and it's the worst kind of attack on the media, because it comes from a fellow journalist. It comes from the sort of person who should understand this. I have no doubt in my mind that Owen Harris has been subject to the most vile abuse by Republicans, or by socialists, or by communists. I have no doubt that his mailbag in the 80s was overflowing, and that his inbox in the 90s and the 2000s has been overflowing with all manner of bile and vitriol. But that doesn't make it right. That doesn't make it a tactic that you can adopt to try to intimidate people that you don't like. And in fact, the entire career of Owen Harris has been about the intimidation of Sinn Féin, the intimidation of the IRA, the attempts to silence the opposition. And there he is doing it himself. So it's the hypocrisy of this. And then to see the people who are coming out to defend him. And there are absolutely no surprises. As soon as the cavalry started coming over the hill, you could see exactly who it was. It was the same type of, you know, somebody described as almost messianic level of dickheadry that was happening. The same people who would write the same kind of columns, the same blinkered fools who would write these things, were riding to the front line to defend Owen Harris for what had happened, knowing full well that what he has done is utterly indefensible. It is utterly indefensible. I remember saying years ago to a soccer player that I was interviewing at the time, and this is a person I got along with reasonably well, and this person was starting to misunderstand the relationship that we had, and I had to explain to that person, when the dictaphone goes on, you and I aren't friends, right? And we can be friends, you know, when the dictaphone is off. We can have a chat, we can have a bit of fun. But at the end of the day, ultimately my job is to hold you to account. And if I find you doing things that you shouldn't be doing, then I'm afraid I can't stick up for you anymore. And not only that, I'm going to have to report on what it was that you were doing and the damage that you are causing and the victims that you have exploited, if that were the case, right? And that's the inability to be able to say that from people who are paid, and in some cases very well paid, for their opinions in newspapers is absolutely sickening. The fact that this is the hill that they would choose to die on. And I would hope that out there today, that there are editors sitting down now, putting their Sunday papers to bed and looking at the tweets and looking at the Facebook posts and the Instagram posts of certain people and saying, you know what, I don't want this person around anymore. This person who would back someone who attacks other journalists and is a journalist themselves and who should understand the damage that they're doing, not just to the people they're attacking, but to our credibility and to all of us, I can't have these people around anymore. Now, I'll make you a little prediction, right? None of that's going to happen because certain people, certain contrarians in particular, who are capable of saying these things, who are, you know, who will go out and sort of, you know, say the most outrageous thing possible about somebody who they know doesn't have the power to attack them back, somebody who they know doesn't have a platform to respond from. They're the kind of people who sell newspapers. They call them shock jocks in America for a reason. The more they can shock without ever being held to account, the more valuable they are, right? And people, they want to see this. That's why people buy tabloid newspapers. I think I spoke about it on the podcast before, that when the Evening Herald went in format from being a broadsheet to a tabloid, they swore that they would never become a tabloid newspaper in the English sense of the word. And not only has the Herald kind of become like that, and very quickly became like that, pretty much every newspaper in Ireland has gone down that road. There has always been a proud tradition in Sweden, the tabloids here are called Kvällstidningar, which is, it's basically the evening papers is the direct translation of it, but that has been the synonymous with tabloid kind of reporting, right? Now, there's a place for that. I don't like it. I don't often want to be part of it. But the Swedes will be a little bit more serious in that you can tell the difference between what is kind of the, you know, their tabloid part and what is supposed to be their quality journalism. But in Ireland, it just seems that that's the way they're headed. And if you're headed that way, there's only a handful of columnists who can actually be serious, who can actually be credible in that situation without throwing their toys out of the pram and just going, you know what, I'm going to go for the lowest common denominator. If we go back to that dynamic of power just a little bit, this whole idea of anonymity, there are very valid reasons for somebody wanting to be valid or for somebody wanting to be anonymous online. In some cases, it might be somebody who has been a victim of something. It might be somebody who's living with a protected identity because of, you know, something that has been visited upon them. It might be somebody that is tweeting about, say, their job, for instance, and you'll hear more about that in a couple of minutes. It might be somebody who is whistleblowing via their account. It might be somebody who basically cannot be, their name cannot be out there in public just because of the situation that they find themselves in. And that's fine. So there is a role for anonymity. I'm not one of these people who say, oh, you know, you should have to scan your driver's license to get a Twitter account. No, I would hope that people are sort of adult enough to be able to say that, if I have to have my anonymity, well, then I actually have to hold myself to a higher standard. But that wasn't the purpose of anonymity for Owen Harris. The purpose of Owen Harris and his friends being anonymous was entirely selfish. It was to protect themselves and their position of privilege, right? Not to protect themselves from attack or that, but to actually actively attack others anonymously. And that really is the lowest of the low. My good friend Ewan McKenna was out on Twitter a little bit earlier today. Now, Ewan and I, we get along famously, right? I don't agree with him. I don't agree with a lot of the stuff he said recently. I discuss it with him. We often end up agreeing to disagree. I often think that he can be over the top and he thinks probably the same about me. But at the same time, I don't attack him personally. I don't say that he's a bad person. I sometimes say that his reporting has come up short and he says the same about me, right? But he was talking about longing for the day when if somebody had something to say, they would say it to your face. And occasionally you got a slap for what you said, and that was the beginning and the end of it. But at least they had the courage of their convictions to stand in front of you and say it, right? Now, I am by no means advocating violence, much and all as I love it in a sporting sense. I am by no means advocating violence, but you can see what Ewan means, right? There's a whole different level of investment in talking to somebody or about somebody when using your own name than there is compared to using an anonymous account, right? There's just... it requires courage. Everything you say under your own name, as Pat O'Mahony says, you know, on that billboard outside your mother's house, everything you say in public has a price, right? There is the Overton window. We do have a level of acceptance for certain things. And so that changes all the time. It shifts. Sometimes you can say certain things, sometimes you can't. Like when I was growing up in the 70s and the 80s in Ireland, very few people would allow you to publicly criticise the church. There is still a thing in Sweden where people don't talk about their own personal drug consumption. They don't talk about their own alcohol consumption other than saying, you know, I was very drunk. But they would never sort of talk about these things. They would never admit to anybody else that they had taken drugs, because basically, you know, the attitude towards that is, oh, you know, train spotting was made about you, you know. But so there's always an investment, a personal investment, your own personal credibility when you say anything under your own name. And all of us self-censor, right? And I've said it before, you know, if you want to find out the limits of free speech in inverted commas, right, go home and call your mother the C-word and you'll find out exactly how much free speech you've got, right? We all self-censor, and society censors us all because we know that there are things that are acceptable to say and things that are not acceptable to say. We know that there are ways that we are able to behave and allowed to behave, and we know that there are ways that society will not accept. And we accept that at every other level, but there will always be people who push the boundaries. But that's not the case here. Here, all you have is pure, unadulterated cowardice and bullying. And that's why now, when the rehabilitation protest starts, and it's already started, you know, Harris seems to be, people seem to want to see him back in his bully pulpit in the Sunday Independent, right? You see people coming out and supporting him and saying what a great mind he is and what a great man he is. He's a shithead, right? If you come out and you do something like that to a young female reporter or to any other reporter or to any other person, you're human garbage and you have no place in journalism and you have no place in the media. The other subject that I just wanted to inform you of, and I'm hoping to do something a little bit deeper, and this is one of the people that I wanted to do a podcast with this week, was there was a documentary recently made and published here, and it was called The Illoyal Healthcare Worker. And what essentially was 102 minutes about how the COVID-19 pandemic has been handled here in Sweden. And I knew the content of it, right? It's one of these stories that I've known about for a long time. I haven't really been able to make it stand up, and I haven't had the time recently, because about 4 months ago, I tried to do this story and I ran into so many brick walls and I had so many other things to do that I just didn't have the time to dedicate to this particular story. And then the next thing, this documentary came out. I think it was only published last week, came out in two parts. And it was done by Sveriges Radio, which is the public service broadcaster here. And what is amazing about it is that it's about an elderly care home, which is probably about 200 metres from where I'm sitting, right? And sometimes when I come in here to my little office / studio in the morning, sometimes I can park right outside the door. But in Scandinavia, you have, in all the big cities, you'll have cleaning days. And the cleaning days are for the snow. So during the winter, you can't park there because, like on a Monday or on a Friday or on a Thursday, because the snow ploughs have to be able to come down the street and clear the streets of snow. So it's Mondays and Fridays in the streets where I live. So those are in the streets where I have the studio. So those days I often have to drive up to the other side of this old folks' home and I walk through it. I actually walk through the grounds of that to get down to my little office and my little studio. And what was happening there, if you cast your mind back a year to the beginning of the pandemic when we didn't really know anything, we still talked about a droplet-borne virus. If you listen back to Eamon Dunphy's podcast, The Stand, I was probably on it maybe 10 or 12 times in the last year, and I spoke about a droplet-borne virus in the beginning because that's what we were being told by scientists. And now we know that it's airborne, and that has basically changed the game for how we are dealing with it. You know, the biggest thing that you can do, I suppose, in many settings now is to open a window and wear a mask because, you know, if you stop those droplets getting out there. Anyway, this old folks home, you will have certain people who are just basically very old, you know, in their 90s, who aren't able to look after themselves, but you will also have people who are suffering from various forms of Alzheimer's and dementia. So in the very beginning of this pandemic, Sweden, as I told you all before, has sold out an awful lot of its public services, right? So this is one of the only countries in the world where you can run a school to make a profit, right? And it's the same thing with elderly care. And when I moved here in 1999, the state still owned pretty much all of, not all, but certainly a vast amount of, you know, dentistry and medical care and elderly care and daycare for children. And that has changed utterly. So during the time I've been here, there were two centre-right governments, and there was a massive amount of privatisations. One of them actually happened at the daycare centre while my kids were in it. And the people there ended up enlisting my help because they weren't really sure they knew what was going on, if it was legal at the time. But what happened at this place, which is run by Attendo, Attendo is the biggest healthcare company in the Nordic region, right? It makes millions every year, hundreds of millions. Like, there's like ridiculous amounts of money. So they're running this old folks home up here. And in the very beginning, they said to people, okay, we're going to do what's called cohort care. Okay, it's cohort vård in Swedish. And what that means is that you don't mix people who have symptoms with those who don't. You don't allow them to come into contact with one another, right? So they wrote to everybody, like to all of the relatives of the people who were there, and said, don't worry, your relative is going to be fine. Your mother, your father, your grandmother, your grandfather, they're going to be fine because we're doing this cohort care thing. We're keeping them separate. And if it should happen that a nurse or a healthcare worker here would come into contact with somebody who is infected with COVID-19, well, then they will only work with COVID patients until we know that they're healthy again. And that was in emails, and that was on the company website. What was actually happening on the ground was something completely different, right? So there was no separate units. So the residents weren't kept apart. They live in corridors. They have their own rooms in corridors. It's quite a nice little setup. So they're not like wards. They have their own private rooms. They can have their things in there. But you would have people with dementia who, you know, you can't lock them in their rooms. So they would leave their rooms. And all of a sudden you might have somebody who had a temperature earlier on the day and might have COVID. And then they come into contact with other people and they might actually pass that on. But Attendo, you know, in public was saying, oh, that couldn't possibly happen here because we separate them immediately. That wasn't happening. And then you had a situation where with the staffing levels, and staffing is always an issue when it comes to private healthcare, private childcare, when it comes to private things at all, the more you can reduce wages, that's more money that you can put in the pocket of shareholders, right? So they would have night staff on. And, you know, what are they supposed to do? They say, oh, you know, well, you have two different units and the two people working at night, usually women, of course, they will be able to help each other. Yeah, but what happens if one of them comes into contact with somebody who might have symptoms? Okay, that she's then out the window or he is then out the window and the other way around. And what happens if one of them has to leave their unit and go to another unit and in the middle of the night, one of the residents gets it? You can see where this is going, right? This whole idea of cohort care fell apart because of a lack of staffing and because of a lack of resources and a lack of facilities. So one woman who worked there contacted her boss. The boss couldn't help. She contacted the regional manager and they couldn't help. And they sort of said, oh, well, you know, this isn't a problem. She tried to contact the managing director of the whole company and that didn't happen. And when nobody helped her and when nobody heard the warnings that she was given, she decided she was going to go to the Expressen newspaper, which is one of the tabloid evening newspapers that I mentioned earlier on that happened to be writing about this. And there was a big thing about it, right? But in the meantime, COVID had made it in to the place where she worked. And as she put it herself in the radio documentary, she said they were dying like flies and that they couldn't control them. And they were passing COVID from one patient to the next. And basically, as we all know, when COVID got into, you know, any sort of elderly care setting, that was it. It was like anybody who survived, I think. From the statistics I remember, I was driving yesterday when I was listening to it, so I couldn't write these things down, but I think she said that about 70% of the people that she was caring for died in this time. And so she went out in the media and she said, look, this is what's happening here. And that, like, you know, the company said, oh yeah, we'll do this, we'll do that. That's not what... Now, they still didn't admit that the cohort care that they had promised people wasn't happening. And So that everything was done. And then late last year, she was called to a meeting. This female healthcare worker was called to a meeting. So she went to the head office. And there she was given a warning because of her illoyalty towards the company. Not towards the patients, but towards the company that she worked for. And she was accused of saying things in the newspaper that were untrue. Now, there's a huge problem with people who don't understand journalism and who actually can't read a newspaper or an article and understand what it is they're doing. So if you have a source and that source is going to be named, then you attribute things to that source. You say this person said, right? There were other things that people, they had interviewed other people for these stories and other people had provided them with information, and they did so anonymously. Not everybody was as brave as this woman, Sina, who came out and said all these things on the record. But what they did was that they took the whole thing as being one big pot of jam, and they said, oh, you know, you were the one who said everything that was in this. And she said, no, I didn't say that at all. I didn't give them this information. I didn't give them this photograph. There was a photograph of a lack of PPE, personal protective equipment. And, you know, she said, I didn't do those things at all. The things I said are the things they quoted me on. That's it. Now, you might think that that's harmless enough, right? She got the warning. She was asked to sign it. She said no. She walked out of there, right? But there's a thing in Sweden called meddelarskydd, right? And meddelarskydd is basically whistleblower legislation. So if you work in the public service, and particularly in healthcare, and you see something that you know to be wrong, you have an obligation. It's called Lex Sarah, the law of Sarah. You have an obligation to bring that to the attention of the authorities. And you also have the possibility to go to the media, and you cannot, your employer cannot, by law, punish you for that, right? Not only can they not punish you by law for that, they're not allowed to try to find out who it was has leaked information, right? By law, and the penalty for this, if you're found guilty of trying to find out who a whistleblower is in a situation like that, the penalty is up to a year in prison, right? So this is not some, you know, some parking fine, parking violation, but there's actually a prison term involved if you go hunting down whistleblowers in your organization because you have failed. I listened to the 102 minutes of the documentary, and in the end, they called her back in because, you know, the journalist was an extremely skilled journalist who put the whole thing together, and she's one of the people that I'm hoping to bring you a podcast about this documentary, but I just couldn't get hold of her this week because she'd been very busy, understandably. She collected everything, and the healthcare worker had recorded a lot of the meetings that she had, including the meeting where she was given the written warning that she was asked to sign. She recorded meetings whereby they said on their website, Attendo were saying, oh, we have cohort care. But actually in meetings, they were going, cohort care is actually impossible when you have people who have dementia. You know, so you have them say one thing to the general public and another thing to their caregivers and the instructions that they're giving them. So I listened to the whole 102 minutes, and I don't think I've ever been as angry in my entire life. In one way, I was hugely grateful to the journalist. I was enormously grateful to the healthcare worker who came forward by name and let us know these things. But the anger and the disappointment to think that the people of this country, we used to look up to them. From Ireland, we used to look like when I came over here first in 1996, and I saw how this country was constructed, and how it was set up for children and for the elderly, and how solidarity was, you know, it was one of the cornerstones of this society. And to see then that, like, you know, the voters of this country, you know, especially the middle class, it has to be said, and the working class, when you say working class, they're not working class people like you and I would understand it, but the people who had trades, but that had strong unions and had good places to live and solid jobs. And to think that they pissed away the best country in the world, all for slightly lower taxes and some completely idiotic ideal of choice. This idea that, oh, there needs to be choice. People need to be offered choice. No. The problem here is that when you take all these things away and you offer them the choice of going to a school where they can be customers rather than pupils, or when you can offer them the choice of going to a place where you'll be told they'll get one form of care and not another, that's not choice. What people don't need is choice. They don't need choice at all. What people need is for other people to treat them with dignity, with respect, with compassion. And that really, those three things are what pulls the two things I've been talking to you about in this podcast together. Dignity and respect and compassion. Because I'll roll up my sleeves on social media and I'll fight it out with the best of them. But that's not where I want to be. Where I want to be is doing work and presenting things that can make the world a better place. Not wrestling with some fucking idiot who thinks he wants to be out there or who thinks he can take women down a peg or two from behind an anonymous account. That's not where we've got to be. And I'm kind of sorry to end on a low note this week. Next week, hopefully, it's going to be a little bit more positive. But you can't put lipstick on a pig. It's been one of those tough weeks. It's been tough to get a podcast together at all. And it just so happens that when I did manage to do it, the two subjects weren't exactly the most enjoyable to have to listen to. But I suppose if you want to end it on a positive note, Owen Harris is now gone. Somebody will put him on the radio. I mean, it's odds on that he will be on, you know, a mea culpa interview will be broadcast and, oh, I didn't mean it and it seemed like a good idea at the time and I'm like, you know, Father Jack, I'm so sorry. That may very well happen. The fact that that documentary was ever made is fantastic because now, you know, the worst thing in the world for a journalist is that people say, oh, I didn't know. Now you know. Now you can do something about these things. Now you can look at these people and the people who back these people and you can ask them, why are you supporting that? Why are you allowing this to happen? Because as I've said on this podcast and many others, the only thing we really want to do is to create a society where you and me can live out our days in dignity and where our children can live in a world that's marginally better than the one that we left. And that, my friends, is still the big hope. Have a great week, wherever you may be.